Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now this week, in the week's just gone, we've just celebrated 3 whole years of the podcast, Matt. Amazing. Go us.
3 whole years of us chatting about films.
I know, right? And we haven't even got to like...
Kind listeners listening to us do it. I mean...
Yeah, exactly. Thanks to everyone for listening, sharing, sticking with us. Couldn't do the show without you guys and the support of our Patreons and everyone else. It's really been a roller coaster.
It is. We're coming up on 160, I think.
Yeah, we are. We're getting already there. Be 200 before next year's out.
It will.
It really will be. So, to mark the occasion, me and Matt were scratching our heads at FOF HQ thinking, what film could we do? We thought, Saving Private Ryan? Nah. Black Hawk Down? Nah. Another really popular war movie? Nah. Well, I mean, this one might be popular, depending on who
is.
You are.
I would say it is.
So the movie we chose for this week, and if you've read the title of the show, you'll already know, but it is a film featuring one of the great American movie stars. It's John Wayne's 1949 film, Sands of Iwo Jima.
It is. And I remember watching this as a kid, and it's one of those ones that was frequently on TV, but doesn't seem to be anymore. Not very regularly anyway.
No.
And I remember watching it as a kid. And then I vividly remembered when I was watching it again for the show. I remember playing on the stairs in our house, like doing Mount Suribachi.
Hitting the beach.
As like a 6-year-old.
I love it. With a vacuum cleaner pipe extension.
I don't know what I had. I probably had like a water pistol or something granddad got me. But yeah.
I had a plastic Tommy gun. You know, the ones from the joke shops with the drum mag.
Gucci.
I had one of them. Nice. That was cool.
Yeah.
I like it. Nice. I remember seeing like half of this film on BBC One or BBC Two like years back. It's one of their movies where I've seen like half of it. And at that time, I probably wasn't into military history as much. So I've gone, oh, that war movie's cool. And just, you know, switched the channel. But anyway, I think we should get into the cast. Obviously, this week, John Wayne is your main star. But I've called the cast section this week, cast... open bracket, close bracket, the Gunsmoke and Rawhide Club, and it will become evident as we go along.
Yeah.
But starting with John Wayne as Sergeant John M. Stryker, not Riker, got that wrong on the Twitter the other day, got absolutely pelted for that. I was thinking of the Lee Marvin film, I think.
Oh.
And I was like, is it Stryker or Riker? And obviously, I had a smartphone in my hand, I could have checked, but I was trying to get the tweet out.
But you went with classic Maguire brand of getting the name wrong.
We've just got to do it. It's just become a trope. Anyway, John Wayne, the legendary American actor, as I said, he was once voted the greatest male star of classic American cinema. And he famously didn't serve during the Second World War, as he was exempt from service due to not only his age, 34 at the time in 1941, but also that Republic Pictures, who he was contracted to at the time, being their only A-list star, might I add, threatened to hit him with a lawsuit if he broke his contract. And he also was family exempt from the American war effort as well. But he did apply to serve with the OSS in August of 1943. And if you check our Twitter, I've shared a page from that application. But he was turned down, something which was said to him he was bitterly regretful of in later life. And it's become a bit of a meme, a bit of a legend that he refused to fight. But it's not really the truth. I think the myth has outweighed the truth there.
People always point to his name, his actual non-screen name, Marion, and like, Marion didn't serve and all this kind of thing. But I think it's really interesting that he applied for perhaps one of the more secretive branches of the US military intelligence community after being such a prominent public figure. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Here's our newest spy, John Wayne. He wouldn't work,
would
it? You
can just picture, some unsuspecting Germans being like, is that John Wayne?
I'm here to do some secret stuff, Pilgrim. That's the first one. But no, I just thought I'd set the level straight there if people didn't know. I think him not serving in the war isn't a reflection on him as a person, because he clearly wanted to be involved. And he did a lot of press touring. He did a lot of help with the war effort in terms of propaganda stuff and doing tours for troops. So he did his bit.
That's fair.
Exactly. But he's no stranger to war films. He appeared in The Flying Tigers, The Fighting Seabees, Back to Bataan, They Were Expendable, Ocean Pacifics, Flying Leathernecks, The Wings of the Eagles, The Longest Day, and In Harm's Way. And, that's a lot of films. I've got a box set on my shelf. There's all John Wayne war movies, the John Wayne War Collection, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it's got all those classics in there. But he initially turned down the role of Stryker as he felt that he was too old at 42, but later took the part and he was paid $380,000 for the role. Not a small amount of money for anyone. And he also received his first Oscar nomination for the role of Stryker. He didn't win, though. And he spoke to Alan Iles for a 1979 book on his career, and he spoke about being a reactionary actor, saying that he wanted to react as if a real person would rather than act the part. And he also spoke about being killed off in the film, and he said, I like the way they had me die in The Sands of Iwo Jima. Duane's a damn fine director. Guy hands you a cigarette, you say, stick around me, you live longer, pow, and he's dead. That's all. Then we have John Agar as PFC, Peter Conway. He was an actor pre-war. He served in the Army Air Corps during the war. He was married to Shirley Temple for 5 years, from 1945 to 1950. Bit of a voice crack there, leaving that in. and he starred alongside Wayne in Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Big Jake. His war film credits include Breakthrough in 1950, Jet Attack 1958, and he also appeared in westerns such as Rawhide and one episode of Combat 1966. Then we have Forrest Tucker as PFC Al Thomas. He's the boxer. He was an actor pre-war as well, served in the US Army during the war, becoming a second lieutenant. Post-war, he signed a contract with Republic Pictures, which led to his casting in the film. His credits include 1942 Submarine Raider, Parachute Nurse, which is about the Aerial Nursing Corps, which I think would be interesting to cover.
Do that. Yeah.
1951's Oh Susanna, Fighting Coast Guard and Warpath. They were all released in 51. And he also starred on TV in F-Troop, Gunsmoke and Rawhide. And he later did appear in Columbo and Murder, She Wrote. Then we have Wally Castle as PFC Benny Regazzi. He's an Italian actor who emigrated to New York in the early 1910s. His war film work includes 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, Story of G.I. Joe, 1 Minute to Zero, and his TV work includes Rawhide, Gunsmoke, and the Beverly Hillbillies. A lot of Western TV shows back there. Then we have James Brown, not that James Brown, as PFC Charlie Bass. He was in 1942's Wake Island, 1943's Air Force, Objective Burma, Sea Hornet, and Jet Pilot. He also appeared in Gunsmoke, Starsky and Hutch, Murder, She Wrote, and Dallas. Nice. Then we have Richard Webb as PFC Handsome Dan Shipley, famously played Captain Midnight on the TV serial in the 50s. And he also starred in 1946's OSS alongside Alan Ladd. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It was an OSS movie.
See that one.
We do. 1951's Distant Drums, and also no stranger to popular TV of the time, appearing in Gunsmoke again. Get Smart.
Was he in Rawhide at all?
He wasn't in Rawhide, oh, no. Okay. He must have been busy that day. He was in Get Smart, The Mod Squad, and $6 Million Man. Then we have Arthur Franz as Corporal Robert Dunn. He also serves as the film's narrator. He served as a B-24 navigator during the war, and his war movie credits include Jungle Patrol, Eight Iron Men, The Kane Mutiny, Battle Taxi, The Young Lions, and Anzio. So we've mentioned him on the film before. And he also appeared in Gunsmoke and Rawhide. Then we have Richard Jekyll as PFC Frank Flynn, in quite a early-ish role for him. Best known to us around here as Sergeant Bowron in the Dirty Dozen franchise, but he also appeared in Battleground, Attack and Combat, and of course, Gunsmoke. Then we have the two female actors of the movie. Julie Bishop playing Mary the Bar Girl. She was in Sabrejet in 1953, which is a Korean War aerial epic. Then she was in The Threat in the 30s and The Black Cat. Then we have Adele Mara as Alison Bromley. She was a dancer turned actress, and she also starred with Wayne in 1948's Wake of the Red Witch and The Fighting Seabees, and she also appeared in Hornet, the Sea Hornet. And that's the main players, really. We also have William Murphy, Martin Milner, George Tyne, and Hal Baylor, and Leonard Gumley, who also play Marines. And then, really interesting, we have Iwo Jima flag raisers, Ira Hayes, John Bradley, and Rene Gagnon, playing themselves, recreating the famous Iwo Jima flag lift for the film.
Yeah, there's that scene where Wayne hands him the flag.
Yeah, I like that bit.
Hands those three the flag. They kind of like close in and awkwardly look at the camera, and he hands them the flag.
Yeah. I was apparently, like, I did the Leonardo DiCaprio meme going, whoop.
Yeah.
It's Ira Hayes.
Apparently, that is the actual flag that was raised.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The Marine Corps Museum at Quantico allowed Republic to use it for the
film. Really cool. That's really cool.
According to the LA Times, anyway.
Oh, wow. Ira and John and Rennie being like, oh, this old thing. Let's get it up again, lads. Come on.
Yeah.
Or quick, because I want us to do another war bond tour. Other famous Marines play themselves, including First Lieutenant Harold Shrier, who led the flag-raising patrol on Mount Suribachi, Colonel David M. Shoup, who won a Medal of Honor during the Battle of Tarawa. He later served as the commandant of the Marine Corps, resigning in the 60s over the American involvement of the Vietnam War. He was dead against it.
Wow.
Yeah. Then we have Lieutenant Colonel Henry Jim Crow, a U.S. Navy Cross recipient, who commanded the 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines at Tarawa, along with 2,000 Marines who were used as extras.
Yeah.
And that's your cast.
Crow is the chap with the waxed moustache.
Yeah.
Who's in front of an LVT giving like orders and such.
Really, really nice to see. I like how all the CEOs essentially are playing themselves. That's a nice little touch.
It's good. It's nice that they get them in just by having like little radio conversation.
Yeah. And it's like actuality stuff. So it really fits in nicely.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about
things. They've got that classic, not too comfortable on the camera acting style.
Yeah. No, it's fine. It's a bit blocky in places, but it's absolutely fine. And it's great to have a movie where they've included them, because it's quite very much a Marine Corps movie, so it's nice to have
them
involved. So Matt, maybe you should do production now, and then we can have the retro review.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, directed by Alan Dwan. He started his career with silent films, including Soldiers of Fortune in 1919. He later went on to do films like The Three Musketeers in 1939, Friendly Enemies in 1942, Abroad with Two Yanks in 1944, and The Wild Blue Yonder in 1951. And in between that, a whole plethora of noir films, comedies, adventure movies, all sorts of different things. The film had a 1.1 million budget, although
huge.
Wasn't quite planned to be quite that much, but it ran over a little bit. And it turned out to be Republic Pictures' biggest film to date.
Yeah.
When it was released. The story was devised and then co-written by Harry Brown, and he joined the US Army in 1941 and then went on during the war to write for Yank magazine and also wrote part of the narration around the True Glory documentary, which was nice. Released in 1945, which looks at D-Day and the Normandy landings.
Yeah.
After the war, he went on to screenwrite. He wrote A Walk in the Sun in 1945. Only the Valiant in 51, Apache Drums in the same year, Bugles in the Afternoon in 52, Eight Iron Men, another mention, nice. In 1952 as well. And he later wrote a 1963 episode of Combat.
Yay!
Yeah.
What one?
I can't remember. I haven't got that in my notes.
Fair enough.
Sorry. which was the one from 1966, Rob, that you mentioned earlier?
I don't know myself.
Don't come for me. So the film was co-written between
Simon Mayo would have got that on their pod.
Yeah, they'd have, you know, known.
Commode would have known that.
I know, true. So Brown co-wrote the film with James Edward Grant. He wrote a raft of John Wayne movies later on. Some of his notable military-esque movies include The Plunderers in 1948. The Flying Leathernecks, which you mentioned a moment ago in 51, The Last Wagon in 56. And he also wrote episodes of M Squad with Lee Marvin. He's got a Lee Marvin mention in there.
Nice.
And also he wrote the Alamo, which is, of course, the big John Wayne picture surrounding the Siege of the Alamo, and Hostile Guns in 1967. Music was provided by Victor Young. Cinematography was handled by Reggie Lanning. And as you already mentioned, the film's technical advisors were some of the ground commanders of the actual Battles of Tarawa and the Iwo Jima.
It really shows that they were involved.
Yeah, there's certain bits, isn't there? Like the Tarawa landing, there's certain angles of that just feel really authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get back
like
to that.
They looked
really
quite
good.
Carefully at that contemporary footage, which we'll talk about later, and photographs and stuff. The film was filmed at the Marine Corps base at Camp Pendleton. I think some of the landing sequences were filmed at the Leo Carrillo State Beach, the Santa Catalina Island, Channel Islands, Thousand Oaks, and Republic Studios and Universal Studios. So they filmed a lot around on different sets, and I think a lot of the internal stuff with the bars that they visit and some of the streets they walk down, a lot of that was Universal and
clearly a sound stage at some point. So,
And as you mentioned, it's Wayne's first nomination for an Academy Award, but it was also nominated for Best Film Editing. Brown was nominated for Best Motion Picture Story, and the Republic Studios Sound Department was nominated for Best Sound Recording, but none of them won.
Wow. I think all the King's Men cleaned up that year, I think, from my reading.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
No, I haven't seen that one either. I think it made or has made around 4 million in rentals since. I think I remember reading
whenever
that.
Whenever you see that figure on sites like IMDb and Wikipedia, I always wonder, when did that calculation stop?
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like some of those stopped in the maybe late 90s, 2000s.
I think so. I mean, it clearly has made its money back. Most John Wayne films turn a profit anyway. So
I don't think Republic even exists anymore, but yeah.
No, I don't think they do. Moving on to the retro review this week comes from Variety from December 31st, 1949. And they say, this is a vast saga of a Marine platoon whose history is traced from its early combat training through its storming of Iwo Jima's beaches to the historic flag-raising episode atop the Sandy Atoll on the morning of the February 23rd, 1945. It's loaded with the commercial ingredients of blazing action, scope, and spectacle, but falls short of greatness because of its sentimental core and its superficial commentary on the war. Interesting.
I like that it does do that that classic thing of showing a platoon being molded in training and then throwing them into battle and seeing how they cope. And
it's like proto Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. though so many films have done it, like Harper and Ridge, and so many have done it. But yeah, there's a number of places where it kind of does sort of stumble a little bit, I think.
A little bit. I think it, well, we'll get to it later, but I really think it spends a lot of time out of the training, out of battles that really do drag and do not a lot, in my opinion, to really establish anyone other than Stryker.
Yeah, they're trying to establish all those characters.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite work.
No.
You know, you look at a film like Battleground, and that does it really well. You know, there's a dozen other films you could pick out. If you take 40 Years Later, Heartbreak Ridge, that film does a very long preamble. Like three quarters of the film is preamble of them getting ready for this op, or just being Marines, and that does
But it's less static than this. That's the thing, that Heartbreak Ridge is less static in its
perhaps so.
In its building up of the people. Like, I think this one is a little bit static.
Mm.
Like, when John Wayne's not on screen, I'm like, when's John Wayne going to come back? Because these ancillary characters are a bit, they're not boring, but they're just not interesting enough.
No, they don't have the weight behind them in their characterization.
Conway, like, they don't really, he's most great. Interesting one.
I mean, obviously he's the main focus for them because he's the arguably second billing
son of the son of the dead colonel,
yeah, and he has the chip on his shoulder, which we'll talk about later on. But he begins to grate, honestly.
Fair enough.
For me, anyway.
a little bit. There's some characters where you're like, yeah, you're just in it so Stryker can shout at you.
Yeah, kind you're of. Just in it so Stryker can butt stroke you.
Yeah, or fight you, you know, or hit you for having a coffee when you shouldn't have a coffee. Anyway, moving on to the one-word reviews. And we had another bumper crop of one-word reviews. Thanks again for everyone who got lots involved. This week. Yeah, I know. Well, you pick popular films, mate. You get popular response. Like, it's who knew?
It's always a surprise for me, Rob. I mean,
I know, right?
we do so few of these popular films.
I know, right? Going against the mission statement of the show this week, anyway. So moving on with them, we have World War II. Paul Woodage says, saddle up. Brian Williams goes with lock and load. Kevin Getz says, in the minority here, but overblown. Mm-hmm. Historical Firearms, our very own Matthew Moss, goes with Pilgrim. Doghouse Riley goes with Suribachi. David Current says, the Duke. Eddie Bond goes with Marines. Tony Pollard goes with Coarse Content. We have... Stephen O'Neill with Tremendous. Ian Miles says Cheese. Hobby Buzzard goes with War Dodger. And Dr. Grant T. Harwood goes with Surprisingly Good. And rounding off this week will go with Ian Gorey, that goes with Gritty.
I like the the range of views we have there.
There were quite a few. Yeah. I think with John Wayne movies in particular, it falls down to whether you like John Wayne or not.
Oh, like, that's a very good point, actually.
I think that really falls into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's that whole thing of the 50s, 60s Hollywood system where, obviously, you know, we're not coming out of the studio system, but, you know, you have certain contracted stars, things like that. So, you know, you get your Cary Grants, your Gregory Pecks, your... Jimmy Stewart's, like, and I think the personality trumps the movie. So it's like, do you like these people from what you've seen of them in the magazines, in the newsreels, whatever, interviews, post career, whatever. So like, if you like the actor, I think you like these movies. And I'm very much in the camp of, I've never disliked John Wayne. Like, I don't get the whole, oh, John Wayne was a bit wooden, and he was a bit this and about the other. He's actually quite a decent actor. Like, that, he gets typecast, but he's good at doing what he does. Mm. Like, it's like Niven. Niven played the same guy in every bloody film, but we love Niven.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that is very true. And if you look at Wayne's career, he is typecast to a degree, but even within that, he does have some scope to do some work. And he was nominated for an Oscar numerous times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
on the strength of his performances.
Like, he says he was, obviously, I mentioned he said he was a reactionary, but he gets it. He gets emotional weight. He can
well,
do it.
That works really well for this film because there's a number of sequences that are built into this where he is reacting. So there's the sequence when they land on Tarawa, and he is, well, they're all bystanders for a while anyway, but he's a bystander watching what's going on with the flamethrower crew and the demolition engineers that are trying to blow the bunker. And then later on, it's the same with when, is it Bass that's calling him? And you get these very tight close-up shots of Wayne reacting, and they are his reaction.
Yeah.
Reactionary.
I don't know how they did it.
Coming to the fore.
But in some of those close-ups, he looks really young. Like, I'm like, is he 42 here? Like,
it's a very powerful arc lamp, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it might be, yeah.
Like, yeah, I think lighting did a pretty interesting job. Because he does look...
smoothing out all those mulberries he smoked. Yeah.
Yeah, he does look remarkably young in some of them.
He does.
And there's a number of those sequences where it is literally him reacting, and they are. Mm. It always goes to a very, you know, tight close-up.
Yeah.
And he invariably does a lot with just facial expression.
Yeah, he does.
It's not always something that you associate with
Wayne,
because
I think he can.
He's more known for that physical presence.
Brash, big Duke, you know, that the reputation precedes him. And I think that's more from his cowboy work more than anything else. I think his war work, from what I've seen, is pretty decent. And I think he's maybe bringing a bit more of his A game because of that whole debacle with him not being able to serve. He wants to treat these movies with a level of respect that maybe you're not going to do in a Western, because a Western's a Western, but maybe for him, a war film
more,
was
more serious
of,
material. Yeah.
There's maybe something in that. But before we, you know, absolutely exhaust our John Wayne memory banks, we should move on to the Ali Tally this week. And whatever Acast is hawking.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's time for Ali Tally on Fighting on Film.
My Ali Tally pick this week, and it's a bit of a, I don't know, what would you call it, meta, would you call it? I don't know whether it's ethereal or it's not a piece of kit, essentially. So my Ali pick this week is the things we see through the stock footage. So there's copious amounts of stock footage cut into this movie. They're primarily from 1943's With the Marines at Tarawa documentary and To the Shores of Iwo Jima from 1945. They're both on the American National Archives YouTube channel. You can see them very freely. And they are fantastic pieces of documentary making. Colorized footage mixed in with stock black and white footage. Really good stuff. So in the movie, we get some really cool stuff you just don't get in other war films. So you have Dodge WC-63 T-45 rocket launchers pummeling.
Yes.
Pummeling Sirabachi. My dad used to own a Dodge weapons carrier, and I begged him to turn it into a rocket launcher truck. I begged him, and he wouldn't do it.
Some 3.5s on the back of it, Dad.
I know, right? How cool are they? I must make a YouTube video about them sometime. They're just really cool. They're used in Korea.
Oh, we should do it together. I have a folder full of stuff on them because I meant to do one.
Rocket, American World War II, Korean War rocket launchers coming soon to YouTube channels near you. And then we get some Sherman tanks that were fighting in Korea. One named, which is a Fisher M4A3 Sherman, called Comet 38 with Widowmaker written on its barrel. She served with the U.S. Marine Corps 4th Tank Battalion during the battle. And there's also some American Hargo tanks and LCTs, Willis Jeeps, things like that. But it's not necessarily those things alone, but it's how this stock footage is cut in. Mm. And obviously that's a trope in itself of 40s, 50s, 60s war films, cutting in footage when obviously, oh, we can't afford a destroyer, so we'll just show a destroyer shooting stuff. But this is one of the much better ways of this being used, because you're replicating Tara, or you're replicating Iwo Jima, but you're cutting in footage not just because you have it to use, but you're using it in a clever way. So,
oh, totally.
There's a section where Thomas has a cup of coffee and he doesn't go and help his mates and they get killed. But there's a section where he's going up to meet them, which is cut in of an American soldier on his own. Yeah. Going through the battle wreckage of Tarawa. And that's just such a great way of bridging gaps between scenes, but using that stock footage to your advantage rather than just going, hey, tanks, hey, rocket launcher. You know, you're actually using
it
in a clever way.
It's much more deft, isn't it? It's handled very lightly. I like the way they do it. I agree.
And there's sections where to some, obviously I've seen those documentaries a few times, but I'm not saying like I'm not any expert on it, but there's sections where, if you're seeing this for the first time, you might not realize that in certain sections you're seeing stock footage because it's cut quite well. And I just really like that. Like there's a reason it got best film editing, because the editing is really great in those scenes. And then I'll come back to Tarawa in the favorite scene section, because it's one of my favorite parts. But that pretty much is my Ali-Tally this week. But I love Marine Corps HBTs. I just think they're one of those iconic uniforms from the Pacific period. And then you even get to see some of the Duck Hunter style uniforms worn by the Marines.
Oh,
in
yeah,
stock footage, which is nice.
Yeah, it's like blotchy. The blotchy one. Yeah,
yeah,
I know the one.
Like Duck Hunter can.
I'm not the uniform guy, but yeah, I know the one you
I love
mean.
It.
Also, I have a question. In a number of the shots on the ships, they have like, is it life belts they're wearing? They have like belts on.
I think there might be life belts.
Yeah, I wondered that.
Yeah, they did, because they did wear them in Normandy, only they had life belts, the black ones.
Right, right.
So they go over like your front. They're like a big strip. Yeah, I think they might have been those.
Okay. I thought that. There's something about the way they use the footage. It really does work well. And I think because the film stock that the film was actually filmed on is relatively close to the film stock that the contemporary footage was filmed using. I think it works really well, because sometimes you see films where they do it, even films in the 50s that do it, but the difference in stock is just too much.
So high.
And you can see it. You can see it instantly.
Yeah.
Where the contrast is completely different, or, you know, it just doesn't quite gel. That was the example you gave of where Thomas is coming back from grabbing the coffee and the ammo. That was, as soon as you started talking about that, that was the exact scene that my mind went to. Yeah.
And there's other sections
it's like 2 seconds of footage.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
It adds a really nice scale.
It's completely, it works so well, because it's just a tiny little bridging, just bridges you to the next scene. But it's nice because you get movement that actors wouldn't necessarily think of doing, and it just adds this level of authenticity to what the actors are doing, and it really, really helps. And obviously having all the Marines as extras as well, like, really helps the movie. You know, I'm pretty sure some of those guys must have been on Iwo Jima and Tarawa. That it's just, you know, the odds are obvious on that one. There must have been some guys who did all three things, you know, one or the other. But it has like a really enriching quality. It really helps this movie. So before I let Matt have his pick, I've got one more pick, and we have to mention it. It's lock and load, as we heard in the one word reviews. As they're about to get in a landing craft, the chap just looks down at the guys and he shouts lock and load. It's really quick. But that's the first time it's ever said on screen or any piece of film, any piece of media that it was said in. Really, really cool. And apparently that term has been used since at least 1940. It was printed in the manual for the it was printed in the basic field manual for the M1 Garand, printed on page 79. And it says with, I checked, it says with dummy rounds, lock and load. So it's in there. But then there's a train of thought that said it was used in from 1899 when someone said it as well. So no one's really sure where the term fully comes from. But in this movie, it's the first time you hear it. And it, obviously, it's gone on to be a, you know, proper military term. But yeah, it's nice. I like it.
That is cool. I like that too. Also, one thing I did notice was towards the end of the film when one of the platoon is killed, he's Jewish and he recites some Hebrew as he's dying.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I thought, wow, God, that must be one of the earliest instances of Hebrew being in a film / war movie.
Yeah. Yeah, an American film at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Just thought it was interesting.
Oh, it's nice.
In terms of Ali kit this week, there's loads. I mean, even if you cut out all the great, you know, contemporary footage,
yeah.
There's some really interesting stuff in there. You've already mentioned the flamethrower tank and the rocket launcher trucks. They're really cool. And the Japanese Hargos and stuff. But we've got John Wayne as an NCO, purely armed with a M1 Garand, which
it's nice, isn't it?
Seems to be like in later films, the NCO is always seen with either an M1 carbine or a Thompson. And that's not wrong. No. But it's interesting to see an NCO throughout the whole film with a Garand. And perhaps that's because of Wayne's stature.
Maybe.
He wouldn't look.
I mean, he dwarfs that Garand. He makes it look tiny.
He definitely wields it, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. In terms of other stuff, I really liked seeing all the LBTs in those sequences,
really cool.
Even the actual sequences where they were filmed. Some of the M2s are actually being used. The heavy machine guns are actually being
That's
used
nice.
On the LBTs in the Tarawa sequence. There's an M1919A4 giving some support. There's an M2 flamethrower, which I think we'll talk about probably during favorite scenes. There's a 1903 A3 Springfield
yep.
in the training montage.
There's one in the landing craft in the Tarawa sequence as well.
Is there?
Yeah, the guy's got one. I think that in its own way, maybe not intentionally, but it does show the US Marine Corps and their history of procurement and the issues that they had during the war, which is, you know, maybe unintentional. But I like the fact that it was in there because, you know, they were still being used.
Yeah, oh, totally, yeah. Then we've got, there's a couple of M1 carbines. The platoon leader or the company commander has them. And there's a couple of others in the background. When they land on Tarawa and they attack the pillbox, there's a Type 96 light machine gun, which is giving an MG42 a run for its money with the rate of fire.
Yeah.
It
know,
is blasting.
Hell for leather. Yeah.
Like, it's got a rate of fire.
In the lock or something to get it in fire.
God knows what he's doing. The Type 96 has a rate of fire of about 550 rounds per minute, which is like a very steady rate.
Where it's
not the buzzsaw that you get in those Tarawa sequences, which is like 1,000 rounds per second by the sound of it. Definitely MG42 territory. But it's effective. It makes it all the more foreboding. And then one of the last things I did spot was the BARs are the early pattern.
M1918A2. I spotted that a mile off. I was like, man, yeah. Say their first war ones. He won't let that slide. Yeah.
No, they've got the classic big chunky handguards at the front and the lack of bipod. And to be honest, the original was better than the A2, I think, as an automatic rifle / light machine gun.
They blast away with it in this, don't they?
They do. And there's actually a nice sequence where the two chaps in the dugout are running out of ammunition and he single shots.
That's nice. Yeah.
And that's a good inclusion, because it just adds to that we're running out of ammunition.
Mm.
And yeah, there's a bit where the guy like pulls the bayonet, a very alley bit where he pulls the bayonet out of his backpack.
Haversack
and slots it on. I like that too.
I'll say that as well. That's probably the most M1936, or was it M1937 pattern webbing? Can't remember. But that's the most of those haversacks I've ever seen on film. Like, there's a bit where guys, and I know it's not stock footage because I went and rewatched the Tower of a Doc to work some stuff out, because I'm a nerd. And that shot of the guys getting out of the LCT, which is like a close shot, and they've got like about 20 lads or whatever getting out, they've all got that webbing on. And obviously that's because the Marines are involved, it's the kit's still in service.
Definitely.
But to have that is really nice, and then to have guys taking them off and just run the rifle belts is really nice. I think I spotted a Thompson in a background shot where a guy had it like up on his, like he was just holding it up, but I couldn't be sure. But there's definitely one or two in the stock footage, but I guess that doesn't count because it's real. But I think for Ali this week, in terms of kit the movie's got, I don't think there's anything wrong that I can think about, really.
Not that jumps out, anyway.
No, there's a replica, well, they've made their own flame-throwing Sherman, and it's got an extra barrel, and that's not right. It should be a little sort of nozzle stuck on the hull with a trailer behind for the petrol. Mm. But I must have assumed they've rigged their own.
I wondered whether that was a
post-war. Version.
Yeah, I wonder whether that was a post-war.
It could have been.
Tank.
It could have been. I'm not hot on my flame-throwing tanks.
No, I tried to find out and I couldn't find anything. There was a couple of like models that showed that, and they associated them with the Korean War. But then when I tried to like dig a little bit deeper, I just couldn't find anything. Because
maybe some Korean War flame tank experts out there can set us straight on Twitter.
Let us know.
Yeah, please let us know. In terms of Japanese kit, again, there's Arisaka rifles.
There is.
They don't look 100%, but they're fine. You know, the kit's all right. It's not right. Not properly right for Japanese Second World War.
Yeah, there's no helmet covers. No. The officer's wearing, he's got the white shirt underneath the actual jacket.
Yeah.
I don't think that he would have been wearing in, you know,
probably
at
not.
That point in the battle.
But it's fine. The amount of time, the amount of screen time the Japanese actually get in this is like nil.
Remarkably little, isn't it? It's just a couple of ambush sequences and...
Yeah,
pick up shots.
That's it. And there's possibly, and I don't know if you saw this, but I think we might have a contender for the most unsafe use of a blank firing weapon in a 50s war film. There's a section in the Iwo Jima section where they're going up the mountain, and a Japanese soldier comes out and he stabs the Jewish troop, soldier, and then the guy with the BAR gives him a burst.
Poses
it,
yeah.
It's so close that you see whatever they've packed that blank with, and the muzzle flash, you see it like make his jacket ruffle.
Ooh.
And I'm like, at that range, you do some damage with a blank. And it's
that
just,
is close. Yeah.
I was like, wow. I rewound it a couple of times. I was like, that definitely hurt.
It's like about a yard.
Yeah, exactly.
A meter or so? Not a lot of distance at all.
Just imagine that, you know, film health and safety didn't exist back then. It's absolutely fine. And one more thing before we jump off Ali Tally. And I wanted to ask Matt about this. Is when John Wayne fires his M1 Garand, it's very little recoil and there's very little muzzle flash. Is he firing caps?
He could be. It's tricky to tell. I'd have to look at it again. But there's not a lot of recoil there. And no one reloads. Either.
No, they don't, do they?
Oh, one thing I will mention is actually in terms of reloads is the BAR gunner has the right mag pouches.
He does, yeah.
On his webbing belt, yeah.
They've all got bar belts, which is nice to see.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a good question. I think he's probably firing blanks because I think the action does cycle.
Okay, fair enough. I just wondered, that's all. Because in some
but,
sections...
But the recoil
like,
isn't there, obviously.
Huh. Well, obviously, Big Duke's, you know, soaking it up because he's John
Wayne.
Right,
exactly. It's nothing to him, yeah.
Exactly. And there we go. What a way to leave the Ali Tally there. Into favourite scenes. Matt, take us away.
It's tricky. I did actually struggle to pick one, and I think the two standouts are the actual landing sequences. I think they're the strongest parts of the film. I think they work the best. They have that nice interweaving of the contemporary footage, mm-hmm. and they have a good scale to them. And we've talked about the levels of detail in terms of
you're literally echoing me this week. It's the same for me.
I think that works really well. I won't go into it too much because I know you've probably have some thoughts on it too. One thing I did like was the rare inclusion of the logistics guys bringing ammo ashore.
That's nice. Yeah.
And they're like, how's it going up there? And the same with the mortar crew as well, you know, asking, how's it going? What's it like up there?
But, the most badly timed coffee in cinema history right there.
Right, right. If only he'd just gotten the coffee and gone.
I know, right?
No.
Showing how raw they are still, isn't it? That's the reason.
It is. It is. Yeah. And that's a nice little bit of nuance, to be fair. Another thing that I actually liked was the grenade training sequence, which is classic. Yeah. There's so many parallels with this film and Heartbreak Ridge. It's actually,
it really is, actually.
As you think about it, whoever made Heartbreak Ridge really liked Sons of Iwo.
For sure. You can see the similarities.
You have that range danger situation again, where a grenade throwing range and a young recruit, or he's not a recruit because he's joined the platoon. So they're just doing some remedial training, I guess, getting ready for the next operation. A young Marine throws I think it's an M2 grenade, and he lets go of it and it rolls backwards down the embankment. And John Wayne kind of leaps onto Conway and saves him because he's preoccupied reading a letter from home.
Yeah, a cliche.
Yeah, there's a lot of those in this film.
Gee, I'm going to read my letter on this live grenade range. What a perfect time.
I like that scene.
No, it's good. It's an all right one, yeah.
I don't know whether you're going to mention this, but the flamethrowers, are you going to mention that about Tara? So, well, I'll mention that and then you can...
There's a lot of them, I know that.
Your favourite parts. So there's a really nice section where there's two flamethrower guys that go up, and that's kind of a recreation of Lieutenant Alexander Bonnyman's Medal of Honor winning action.
Nice.
So he led a team, which is great because I'll talk about it. He's actually in the film.
Oh, wow. Okay. Missed him out of cast.
Well, he was killed. So he was actually killed during the operation. So he's in the contemporary footage.
I see. Sorry. Yeah.
So what they do is it's that clever use of footage again. So they include that Medal of Honor winning action where he led the flamethrower team, but they change it slightly and have John Wayne throwing a couple of satchel charges into the bunker. And a little bit later on from that sequence, all the Marines rush up. Once the bunker's destroyed, they all rush forward and they're firing over the ridgeline. And then the film splices in a little bit of contemporary footage, and it's Bonnyman's team getting ready to go up to the to another bunker. So it makes it like there's another bunker.
That's nice.
But it's actually the actual event that they've just recreated.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
He leads that up and actually shows. You don't see him. You just see him and the team.
Sure.
Attacking the bunker. But again, there's another classic trope there. It's the classic demo guy doesn't quite make it to the bunker with the satchel charge.
Yeah.
And the lead character has to do it. How many films are we seeing that do that?
1,000. I think it even happens McQueen in Hell, doing Hell is for Heroes. Yeah. About to say that. Yeah. There's definitely a few more.
Longest Day. Jeffrey Hunter gets it doing that. Yeah. So many. But anyway... You
it's
pick the same thing.
If you see a satchel charge in a war movie and you're not the main character, don't volunteer.
Don't touch
it. You'll buy it in 2 seconds. Yeah. So I echo Matt this week. The Tara landings and the Iwo Jima landings, just they do have the great scale. But for me, the Tara section, I think stronger is the wrong word, but I prefer it in the way it was filmed because the footage use is just expertly done. It's seamless. But I like how it does show Wayne's character. It shows Stryker as this battle-hardened veteran. He's obviously only battle-hardened in Guadalcanal, but I'm sure he was a pre-war Marine as well. You get the feeling he's been in for
a while.
Yeah,
they mentioned he was in China with Thomas, don't they? So you know he's been in since
the '30s. He's seen some shit. And they get on the beach, and you've got all the guys getting out the LCTs, and then they stack up on that sea wall, like the dock kind of area.
Against the logs.
That's it. Yeah, the logs. That's it. That's quite a iconic picture of Tarawa, filming of Tarawa. And the way they do it's really good. I mean, you get ancillary characters being killed off, willy nilly. This film loves doing that. I'll come back to that in a minute.
Classic trope is the young lad losing it and panicking, running off and getting killed.
Yeah, I'll come back to those deaths in a bit because they rankle with me.
We've never seen him. He's not even one of the characters. He's just there to be killed on Tarawa.
It's a little bit irritating. But it shows, it shows Stryker's battle-hardened reputation is valid. The men still hate them, but he proves his worth to them. Whether they like it or not, they have to follow his rule and his lead. And he does get many of them back off of Tarawa. But again, I'm going to come back to this splicing of stock footage because it's just so well done. I think it's got to be up there with one of the finest ways of doing it. It also holds my... favorite is the wrong word, but interesting. My most interestingly fascinating piece of footage from the Pacific Theater. So there's a small clip, and I'm not sure if anyone would know it. It's in the Tarawa documentary. You can freely go and find it. There's this clip of Japanese troops running across an open area, and there's two trees, and there's two Marines covering this little clearing. And you see a group of Japanese troops run across. And the US troops take a few pot shots at them, then a smoke grenade or something explodes, and there's loads of smoke, and they get covered. As far as I'm aware, that's the only instance of footage, I think, from the American Pacific campaign, because I know there's some from Indian troops fighting in the Pacific, and there's some of New Zealand troops fighting in the Pacific, of both sides being captured on film at the same time, not after the fact when they've been captured, not dead on the floor or something like that. It's both factions on screen at one time, and it's some really small clip. But I've always found it fascinating. There's the way I found out about it.
Didn't the Pacific recreate that shot?
I think it might have done, actually, given its recreation. There's a documentary about combat cameramen that was on one of the Saving Private Ryan special DVDs, and it's all about that. And Tom Hanks presents it, and they said in that it's one of the few instances of both factions being on screen. And I like the way it's used.
Very cool.
I also like to see it in film. It's really great. But then that Tarawa section is just really well done. You get the obviously the bit with the coffee, momentary lapse in concentration, your friends die, and you get reprimanded for it later. You see how raw these guys are, even though they've had all of their training and they think they're up for it. They want to get going. And, Stryker's just like, you'll have plenty of time to get at them. Now's the time to take cover. And we finally learn about Stryker and his reputation in combat, things like that. Up to that point, we've seen him as just be this hard, no-nonsense, take-no-shit guy who's training these troops. But, in classic sort of grizzled NCO fashion, once he's in battle, he proves his worth. And obviously he does with the satchel charge. But then he also shows that cold, bitter sort of... seeing the day through kind of thing where they have to hold the line in the evening, and you've got that man screaming for Stryker to come and get him, and Stryker just doesn't waver. He's like, nope, we've got to do a job here.
I don't know whether I'm imagining it, but I feel like I saw a bit of a welling up in those reaction shots, in those tight reaction shots.
Yeah. He clearly knows what he should do, but he can't do it. I like that. It's where that characterization that Wayne's putting into it, and where Stryker comes into his own in those scenes. I think when he's not in battle, I think the character is too cliched for me at times. And I think the obviously every other scene with Stryker in is just to build up to that death at the end with the note with the letter.
I think on that note, we're moving into final thoughts territory.
Yeah, as we always do. I have a couple of issues. Do you want to go first?
Sure. I feel like it's a, a film very much of its time. And sometimes, yes. sometimes we say that when it's a derogatory thing, in that it's a film that has sensibilities or says things that you know just aren't.
Well, there's definitely a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment in this.
There's a great line where John Wayne calls the Japanese little lemon-colored characters.
I know. I was like, wow.
Which is a bizarre derogatory.
Yeah. Of its era, we must have.
Very much so. But what I mean by that is it just has that kind of humor that doesn't quite, you know, it doesn't quite do anything for me.
It doesn't transcend its era, does
some
it?
Some films of the era have similar sort of characterizations and dialogue, and they do work. There's a couple of scenes where it kind of does work. But a lot of it is, you know, very cliched. Just a caveat for a second, we were talking about this before we began to record, and 1949, that's very early on for post-war war movies. They're still very much of the ilk of what was being made during the war.
Yeah.
They're still arguably propaganda pieces. And I think it's early on in those tropes, so perhaps it's a little bit more forgivable. But I just found Wayne's death to be really cliched. It was that happy death. He's expressing, I haven't felt this good in, you know, however long. Get shot.
I thought it was quite hard hitting. I thought it worked. What didn't work for me was the letter reading after.
Oh, I was about to go on to that. Yeah. So I feel when Thomas reads the letter, it's heavy handed.
Really heavy handed.
The sentiment's there. That's nice. But it's just a bit heavy handed for me. The bit where Conway then goes, all right, let's get back in the war. That kind of works. That's okay.
Yeah.
It's cliche,
up the baton. I like that. Yeah. That's good. And it shows that Iwo Jima didn't end with the flag raising, because everyone thinks.
Oh, I know. Go clear the rest of the island. Yeah. But there's two airfields, mate.
There's a whole fucking battle to fight, guys, you know.
But the thing for me is there's a number of points where doesn't quite work.
Doesn't all gel. No, I'll give you that.
And I feel from reading some of the early reviews, you know, from the period, even then there was a couple of scenes for reviewers that didn't work.
Yeah, well, people are worn out. They just had 6 years of this. You know, they know it.
Yeah, but we're entering that golden age of war movies. It's 1950s, 60s. So it's paradoxical, I would say.
I think those 50s, 60s war movies, they're not straight. A lot of them aren't straight recreations of battles. They're, you know, adventure films set in the war, or
no, I totally agree. So
about
as time goes on, they diverge away from whatever they were and become much more. Their movies set against war almost towards the end.
In a sense, your thing about the death of Stryker really, really does hearken to my big gripe with this movie, is that every death is just laboriously carried out. So when the minnow characters who don't have a lot of lines, or just, you know, just learn a little bit about them, when they get killed on the beach in Tarawa, that's fine because they're dead and the movie moves on. Doesn't hang on them. They're shot, they're killed. That is a lot more hard hitting than having every single character who we know a bit more about having a Western style quippy death near the end. Like when they get to Tarawa, the movie really does it badly.
I'll get a good night's sleep.
Yeah. When they get to Iwo Jima, that sort of stuff starts happening, and it just rankled with me in the sense of, you know, you get the, obviously it must be an early cliche of this, but you get the young soldier who's reading, being, you know, hassled for being a bookish guy. Then he gets killed, and you see the name of the book in his top pocket, and he was like, "We were young once," or whatever it was. And I was like, oh, for God's sake. Like, come on. And then you have the guy who goes, yeah, I'll get a good sleep tonight. And he falls. And I'm like, this is Western, like, B-movie Western death stuff. And I tried to think about it contemporarily, where I was like, if I've just lived through the Second World War and I'm American, there's a high chance that someone in my family has fought, died, come back, or whatever. I would feel that it's cheapening these boys' like wartime efforts in cheapening their deaths in a way. Like, there's a way to deal with it, and it just that really annoys. I don't know why, but this. I mean, the thing is, sorry. No,
I was just going to say, there's a couple that do work. The guys that run out of ammunition that are attacked and ambushed, that one works well.
But even he gets a quippy death where he's like, "Where were you?" And I'm like, "We don't need that."
He don't die. He come back.
Oh, he comes back.
Yeah, he's the guy, the corporal, Lance Corporal, that comes back in the tent.
And he tells Conway, really GI blind in this. Everyone merged into totally. Each other.
Oh yeah, I couldn't pick him out, but he must be that guy because he's the only one who would know.
Of course, yeah. So, but my thing there, I would have shot that scene differently because I think when the Japanese guys ambush them, it looks bad. So I would have had them just go into a trench and you see the top of the trench and you see the Japanese guys rise up and bayonet them. And then perhaps when the guy comes back with the coffee, he could have, you know, grabbed him out or something. That scene just didn't, it was nearly there, but the emotional hit of him finding his mates could have been a lot more hard hitting. And that's just movie making of the time, perhaps, and the writing of it. But no, those deaths just really rankle with me.
I think the problem is it's a contrast because they're clearly reaching for a deeper, more sentimental impact, especially with Wayne's character's death. But then with the other members of the platoon that get killed, some of them going up the mountain, that it's blinking, you miss it, they're gone. You get one like 2 second shot of whoever it was,
and that's a lot.
I think
better.
The contrast between that and the more slapstick, for lack of a better phrase,
it's just I don't know
the
why
less,
it annoyed me.
The less, the more empathetic deaths, they kind of clash. I think
they do.
There's a marked contrast between the two.
Mm. Yeah, and then like my other main gripe is just. I think, as you probably agree, the start really drags trying to set everyone up. Like, Battleground does it, but it does it in a different way because they're going from A to B and you learn about them while they're going from A to B rather than being in the same position. And then I feel...
And like no one in New Zealand sounds like they're from New Zealand.
No, I know, right?
Conway marries a New Zealand girl who definitely doesn't sound like she's from New Zealand.
Needless. It's needless. Like, I just felt all those scenes were just typical... nearly 50s B plot of having a B plot.
Well, those sequences have that swelling romantic movie music of the 40s and 50s.
I don't need it in my film about Iwo Jima.
Terrible, clunky dialogue.
Yeah. Flags of Our Fathers made that work because of the way that movie was made and the way the story was being told. I expected to see these guys out of the army, out of, you know, doing their war bond tours, things like that. But like in this movie, I just feel like, please get to Tarawa, please get to Iwo Jima. So what the characterization that you're trying to set up here actually means something. Please.
Yeah, the film really picks up.
Yeah.
Once they get to Tarawa, and then it kind of slows down again where they're back on leave and stuff, and it doesn't really. It kind of develops Stryker a little bit.
When he
meets the hooker.
Yeah,
and finds a baby, you know, in the next room.
But you could have explained him having a kid another way. Like you could have had Conway and Stryker having the chat about, "I don't like you. I'm not going to make my kid join the Marines." That's the way to show
There's so much you could have done there. Conway has, you know, daddy issues, for lack of a better phrase, where his father's a former Marine. Well, Marine Lieutenant Colonel, whatever, and he's died, and his father never thought he was good enough, couldn't hack it as a Marine, etc. So he's trying to prove something to his father. Stryker then becomes the ad hoc father figure who he's rebelling against, and Stryker just really can't be bothered with the you know, the drama, and kind of just
time just, to grow up, Pilgrim. You know,
a number of times where he's just like, "Can we not do this?" You just get that vibe.
Yeah,
but there's so much where you could have had a conversation with them instead of that sequence with the woman he picks up at the bar, where he tells him, "I'm going to be a father." Wayne says, I am a father, but I've made mistakes, which is ham-fistedly like pushed into that letter at the end.
It's all kitchen sink shit. I fucking hate it.
They could have had a conversation about Conway's father, and it could have all, you know, come together a little bit better. Yeah. And the payoff just, between their relationship, where he throws a shovel at the Japanese officer with the sword,
tiny. Yeah,
which is great, but good then scene. I hate the bit where he goes, "Thanks, Marine." They're like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, I know. It just there's parts it's of the movie just, that just don't gel, and it annoys me because it takes away from what is a very good second half. Like apart from those scenes when they're out, when they're not in theater, it drags. But apart from that, and I'm gonna sort of retcon everything I've just said there. Apart from that,
we loved it.
On that, it's absolutely fine, and it watches well. Like it's a proper Sunday afternoon movie. Like
it is. It's one of those
it's
films
still
that
very good
within the war movie genre. It's one that you should watch because it's interesting in terms of when it comes out. In terms of it's the cusp of the Cold War. There's propaganda elements to it still in the way it's presented. It's trying to be a little bit different in, you know, including those moments where Stryker has a complex character, which lead men in that position, NCOs, grizzled NCOs, don't always have complex characters in 50s war movies, 40s
agreed.
War movies. So it has it definitely has things to speak up about.
It has its place. If you enjoy Battleground or you enjoy Heartbreak Ridge, I would say go and watch this one because they're kind of similar ilks. And it's out there, you know, it's rentable.
I'm sure it's still on the US DVD. Marine Corps movie list still.
It probably is, yeah.
I'm sure.
And if you're a fan of the Pacific Theatre, it's a good one to check out. So I think that was 1949's The Sands of Iwo Jima there. First John Wayne film on under the belt there, Matt. Yeah, maybe we'll revisit John again.
Oh, I think we'll have more John down the line.
We can actually do the... The Flying Leathernecks one, so we can do the Flying Tigers one for Merc Month 3 because it's a mercenary film.
Is it?
Because the pilots were mercenaries.
Of course they were. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a Merc film.
Oh, there's loads we can do. Alamo. Yeah. Green Berets.
Green Berets. Oh, I've missed that on the cast. I knew there was one. Yeah. Green
his
Berets
last,
is
his
definitely
last
one.
Real war movie.
But yeah, that was Sands of Iwo Jima yet again. You know, a perfectly fine film. One to watch if you haven't. And as always, please check findingonfilm.com for all your war movie reviews. You can catch up from episode one. If you start and you give us a tweet and let us know where you're starting from and what you're enjoying, we'll give you a retweet. We love to interact with you guys. Do join us next week for another war movie review, and we'll catch you again soon. Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Pilgrim.
Bye, Pilgrim.
Bye, Pilgrim.
That was dire. If we do a John Wayne month, I need to work on my Pilgrim. I really do.
Get off your landing craft and assault the beach, Pilgrim. Oh.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.